Hello, this is Alex Peckham from Peckham Cider, Nelson, top of the South Island of New Zealand, and you're listening to Cider Chat.
Episode 139. Welcome to Cider Chat. My name is Rhea Wincoller, and I'm the producer and cider MC of this weekly podcast, where we speak with makers, cider enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world. And this week, we are speaking to Alex Peckham, who is from New Zealand. This is one part of the world that I have not spoken to yet. A lovely region and country, a place I've always wanted to go to, and we're going to be getting more info on Alex about the changes of the Southern Hemisphere and Northern Hemisphere and how our growing season and whole cider-making culture is kind of flipped upside down, if you will. So stay tuned for that. In the meanwhile, we're going to get a little bit of news out and about in Ciderville. It's getting down to the point where I'm having a hard time thinking about anything except going to Normandy. I know. It's like the beginning of August when this podcast goes live. But essentially, in 2 months' time, I'm going to be in Normandy, France, and going out on a tour with an amazing group of people. We have a mixed group of both couples and singles. It's a really nice balance. And we're going to be landing in Paris. I was speaking with my counterpart there, who is going to be on this tour with us. And we're setting up the logistics for, you know, all the little details. I think we both are like super geeks on logistics. So when folks land and they arrive in Paris, then the next day we head out, we want to make sure that people have food for that travel out there. Because, you know, lunch could seem kind of far away, you're a little jet lag, you're a little sleepy, you're having cider and Calvados probably at 11 o'clock in the morning, if not earlier, right? Because, I mean, cider does go with breakfast. I mean, shoot, they have it with crepes all the time in France. Although I do think they have that as a dinner thing. But anyways, you know, cider is good at any time of the day. So we're setting up like a little snack bag to go along, because after we do that first cidery visit, then we're going to be going to a deli and speaking with my contact there. You know, we really want to set it up where we could be spontaneous, and we've selected a driver where we could say, hey, you know, we want to look at that, or this is a way the group is going to have that flexibility. So I'm just thrilled beyond to be able to offer this experience. We just had a couple sign up, and I had said, you know, we had two more slots, but you know what? Having just spoke to my French colleague, we were looking at what we could do, and, you know, we have the option to bring on four more people. So I'm opening this now for like 2 weeks. So this is going out on August 1st. So you're looking at 2 weeks up to like August 12th, four more people could sign up. And then it's going to be waiting list only, so that I could just be full on all the preparation that I need to do to be able to welcome folks into Paris and to wine and dine with them. It's going to be freaking foodie heaven. All the way through, there's going to be cider dinners and then some time to like hang out on your own and to look at a region of the world that was historically so amazing. There's castles there from way back. We're going to be going, of course, to Mont Saint-Michel, which is on everyone's bucket list. But there's all these little hidden gems that I was able to seek out when I was traveling about and setting up this tour. Little magical gardens, some castles that are kind of like the locals go to. I went to these castles and I walked up and, you know, it's a sign, like a historical sign, but there's nobody there. And I just got to walk around this castle with nobody there. I mean, like nobody was living there either. It's kind of like a castle in ruins, but you open up a little bottle of Calvados, you start sipping on it, you look at the castle in ruins, and I mean, you could go back. You could taste through the Calvados will bring you on that journey. So those are some of the things I have up my sleeve. I am so super stoked to hang out with the people I've done this kind of travel my entire life, leading groups on all kinds of different adventures. It was really my forte when I first started working as a young adult, going and leading trips out into the wilds. A lot of fun doing team building. That was really my passion, doing experiential education. This is a little bit different. This is a foodie and cider and sightseeing, vacay, enjoyment scene. But there's always a dynamic with groups, and I love that. I love being with people and just really getting to know them and to hang out and to have fun. So if you are interested, again, there's a two-week limit now going out. I'm going to be kind of probably popping that out all over the place. Do think about signing up, because this is epic. We're creating history. This is the first cider tour to go to Normandy. All other cider tours have been geared and only set up for commercial makers, and this is open to everyone, because that's the way we roll in Ciderville. I know I'm a cornball too, but I'll dial that back a little bit. Anyways, that is the way we roll in Ciderville, and I hope you do think about coming along. Just check it out at ciderchat.com. Go to the Totally Cider page. There's all the stuff you need there to sign up today and to get in. Otherwise, it's going to be waiting list only. And to miss out on this tour, it would be a crying shame. Really would be. I live in the Northern Hemisphere, but there is a whole group of people in the world who live in the Southern Hemisphere, and their growing climate is kind of upside down from ours. For instance, in Australia, they just had the Midwinter Fest that was put on by Willie Smith on July 15th. So that's winter down in the Southern Hemisphere in that part of the world. And that's kind of where we're going, but we're going a little further south of Tasmania. We're going a little southeast of Tasmania, if you will, a little over 1,000 miles to the country of New Zealand. And New Zealand, if you don't know, is actually two main islands, and they refer to it as the North Island, and that has the capital of Wellington, and then the South Island. And we're going to be speaking to Alex Peckham of Peckham Cider, and they are based on the South Island. And you heard him kind of bring it in on the show saying the top of the South Island. And that's exactly where they are. So again, two islands, they're on the Southern Island, and they're on the top part of that Southern Island, kind of close to Wellington, which is on the bottom of the North Island. I've always wanted to go to New Zealand just because it just sounded like an amazing outdoor place. And I'm a big outdoor aficionado, having led high-intensity adventure-based courses for a good part of my career. And so I know there's a lot of national parks. I know that on the South Island is where they filmed that very famous movie for, you know, the Lord of the Rings and Frodo, and who doesn't love hobbits. I also know that they have kiwis, and people refer to New Zealanders as kiwis because these are birds. And so I don't know, people like to give everybody nicknames. The Maori are the indigenous people to New Zealand, and there's a wonderful movie called The Whale Rider. If you get a chance to see that, it's all about this young woman and how she actually rides a whale and how it was part of that culture. I love that movie. So there's a lot of cool history, exquisite landscape. It's supposed to be really open to tourists, and of course, they make cider. I was able to meet with Alex Peckham at CiderCon 2018 in Baltimore, Maryland. That is the CiderCon is put on by the United States Association of Cider Makers. It's their annual trade conference. We had a sit down, and I could have just talked to him all day. This is such a delightful chat. He delivered so much, and we were able to get a peek into what's happening on their growing season and how it does work in the Southern Hemisphere. So I hope you find that as enjoyable as I did too. So let's go to that chat right now and make sure that our glasses are full, because you're in for a humdinger of a time with Alex Peckham of Peckham Cider, that's based on the top of the South Island in New Zealand.
thinking, why didn't I just stay enjoying it as a hobby?
It's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work. It's fun. It's really fun. You wake up every day and there's a new challenge.
Yeah.
Started as a hobby cider maker, and planted a few trees, which the hare's at. Do you have hares here?
Yes, hares as I have
as in big
a
rabbits.
giant rabbit. I had one as a pet, actually.
Oh,
yeah.
You do? Well, yeah. I unfortunately some idiot decided to import them into New Zealand, and they love apple trees. And so
do they eat the bark at
the
bottom?
Yeah, they ring bark. They I think you've got real problems here with deer.
Yes,
the hares are our problem, and they I think they must get a mineral deficiency at a particular time of year.
Oh,
so they come in overnight, and you'll have no damage one day, and then suddenly, bang! You'll find a whole rose being gnawed, almost ring barked.
Wow.
Sometimes it is ring barked.
So, what do you do for hare prevention?
Well, we on young trees we keep a guard.
Yes,
but even then they stand up above the guard
because they're pretty the size of a hare standing on their hind legs.
It's pretty high.
It's pretty darn high. They're probably how many pounds would you or you probably don't go
pounds,
kilograms.
No. I don't know how many pounds.
Hefty little beast. Hefty little beast. Yes.
So we paint on blood.
Oh,
blood onto our trees. So it's a commercial mixture. So it's a powdered blood that you
buy. Blood.
Dry blood.
Dry blood from. Not other hares.
Not other hares. I'm an unknown animal.
From the vampire sector.
I think it's a North American product, actually.
Probably.
Anyway, so we buy it. It's available locally. So we buy that, we mix it up, and it goes off pretty fast. So it starts to smell of rotting blood.
Yeah.
And the hares being vegetarian.
Like that, no.
And so it's really, really effective at keeping
Who
them away.
Would have thought? That is not an easy job when you're, how many hectares of, trees?
We've got around about 7 hectares.
7 hectares,
yeah.
So
16, 17 acres, I think.
Thank you, yeah.
And keeps us busy.
I bet it does.
Yeah. So it's pure cider fruit. We've made a decision not to grow anything else. If we do need other fruit, which we do get, we can get it from elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So we only grow what we can't buy. And to be fair, that area of land produces quite a lot of apples. So most of our apples are produced on site.
No problem.
And if we want a mellower, not full bittersweet type cider,
mm-hmm.
then we'll bring in some apples from elsewhere, but they will only come from orchards that are grown specifically for us, and they will only come from the tree. They will never come from a pack house. Unripe fruit is, in my view, the bane of cider making. I can taste pack house fruit in the cider. It's got a raw flavour, and I've done side by side comparisons between. So, but I should explain a pack. Well, you probably know. Everybody probably knows this, but a pack house fruit is derived from the culinary stream, and the culinary apple is picked probably 3 weeks to a month early, so that it's still got lots of starch, hasn't had flavour development, but it looks great. It hasn't had time to get any dings or insect mm-hmm. nibbles or anything like that, and also it's got shelf life. They need shelf life. They take that apple, put it in a cold store, and then bring it out periodically, put it through a pack house, the pack house sorts it, and then there are rejects from that stream, and those rejects look magnificent. They're just too big, too mm-hmm. small, they've mm-hmm. got a little imperfection somewhere, wrong colour.
Right.
And they're incredibly cheap because they're a waste product. Mm-hmm. Okay, so certainly in New Zealand, almost all of the cider industry is basically a waste processing industry. Because it survives off the waste stream from this this export industry. And because it's a product that people want to get rid of, because they're processing a lot of apples, they've got this waste stream coming out. Any company that's processing anything that's got a waste stream wants to get rid of it. So we can buy, if we wanted to, packhouse fruit for around about under 10 cents New Zealand cents. That's what's that, around about 6 cents US. Under 6 cents US, a kilo.
Wow.
2.2 pounds. The reason I go on about it is because I think that cider is a great drink and it should be at the level of wine. And I see all these winemakers trying to make low alcohol wine. Why? You've got cider. Why try and make a bad wine when you've got cider, you know? So, but, you know, the winemakers put a lot of effort into their vineyards.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're out there before harvest tasting grapes and testing grapes, trying to find the optimal time for harvest. And yet cider makers are using the wrong varieties and using a waste stream. And it's a real shame because it undermines the potential of what should be seen as the lower alcohol wine. And people are looking for low alcohol.
That's a little bit of the New Zealand national anthem being played in the background. It's kind of on a funky jazz beat, if you will. And I'm sipping on a home block cider from Peckham's, made with both bittersweet and bitter sharp apples. Those are cider varieties or cider styles. And something about this cider is just kicking my butt here because it is so fruit forward. It stops you in your tracks. I want to guzzle it, but at the same time saying slow down and savor this because you don't see this kind of cider too often in a lot of package stores, or what I call package stores, places that they sell cider out there in Ciderville. Really delightful cider. It's 5.9%. And one of the things that they say on here is that no two ciders are alike. And that's something you're going to be getting from this chat with Alex. So let's head back to this. We're going to start delving into the growing season and what happens on the yearly calendar in New Zealand.
In January, right now, is peak summertime. It's the middle of your summer.
Middle summer.
Mid to late February, you start harvesting the apples.
Yeah, so we'll harvest. We've got a couple of rows of a variety called Tom Putt, which, again, is a sharp, multi-purpose apple, which we like. Mm-hmm. We'd get rid of it if we didn't like it, mm-hmm. because it is a pain in the neck, because it ripens so early. Mm-hmm. That fruit, because we don't want to open our press up too early, because we're already going to be pressing for a long time. That's the only fruit we'll cold store, so we'll actually cold store that, but mm-hmm. just to keep it until we can blend it with fruit that comes a little bit later.
So in March, what are you doing in March?
So then basically end of February, beginning of March, the other fruit will start to come on stream.
In. Okay.
That will be varieties like Knotted Kernel. We've got a French variety called Muscadet that will start to come on then. Mm-hmm. And then we'll progress into March and we'll start to see the Kingston Blacks and Browns come on. And then we're kind of going on into April and we're starting to see the bittersweets coming in. So we'll start to harvest the bittersweets. Mm-hmm. And then the last bittersweets, the really late ones for us, will be in May.
In May, okay.
Yeah. And then there will be a few stragglers in June as well, and then we'll bring out our little squeeze box press.
In June, right?
Yeah, and then we'll press those. They'll be small batches.
How are you still pressing into July?
We're not pressing into July, no.
Okay.
We also use, I talked earlier about the fact that we have orchardists that grow fruit for us. So we've got the only block in, as far as I know, in our area of Jonagolds, mm-hmm. That is grown specifically for us. It was a variety that did really well, but there wasn't a critical mass for it to be an export variety. Mm-hmm. So it became kind of a bit of an oddity. So the orchardist that's got it, we have to basically pay him not to pull it out.
Oh,
we do have to pay a little bit more for that fruit, but we really think it's a great variety, and I'm surprised I haven't heard more about it this week as a variety. Mm-hmm. So that is a variety that does ripen very late in New Zealand, and Along with another variety, which is Sturmer Pippin. Do you know that variety?
Sturmer Pippin. No, I do not know that.
It's a sharp apple, but it's a beautiful aromatic apple. And there's a really small grove remaining. It used to be quite popular, but it's slightly challenging to the palate. And all those apples that are challenging to the palate seem to be disappearing in flavor in favor of the more modern, easy eating apple.
Right.
I don't know, but I remember when I had an apple and you used to kind of like prepare your mouth for that attack
know,
of acid.
Know,
it was
right.
really pleasant. You liked
yeah,
it. You
yeah.
know, it was like getting into a hot bath. It's kind of like
no, wakes you up.
It wakes you up. Yeah, but it was great. So anyway, the Sturmer Pippin is one of those. So those apples. We get by that time the temperatures have gone right down, yeah. So those apples we'll get, and we can shed. We can put them in the shed and
store
and store yeah. them. Really get them mm-hmm. ripe, no rot, ripe, different thing.
Right,
and then we can press those probably we can press those right into July. It's a really long pressing season, which is why we put the Tom Putts in storage at the beginning.
Perfect.
And that's great. It's good.
So, wassail? Do you do wassailing or any kind
of... Oh, yes.
You do? And is that in July or into August for you?
It's supposed to be mid winter, but it's midsummer. We have a whole lot of real issues about holidays and things because.
So do you do it in July or?
We do it. It's supposed to be end of June, isn't it? I don't know the specific date to do the moons.
I see. Okay.
But we do it in July.
Well, who wants to do it during pressing season?
I don't organize that. We've got an.
Is it pretty well known in New Zealand as something to do to go to the orchard, or is this more for people who are really more cider fans in that way?
As far as I'm aware, we're the only ones doing wassail. I don't know. And so we...
Is that open to the public?
No.
No, okay.
It's open to anybody who wants to come along.
Right.
But it's not open to public. If we opened it to public, we'd have all sorts of regulations we needed to follow.
I see. Yeah.
So
yeah.
We just keep it really low key. Mm-hmm. But it's driven actually by the local Morris dancers.
Yes.
Or a local Morris dancer.
A group. What is their group called? The Morris dancers.
They're called Black Crow.
Black Crow. I could tell a mischievous group of folks.
They have black face paint on them.
Oh, kind fun.
Of, they're slightly cyberpunk.
Cyberpunk.
They're slightly cyberpunk. They come and do lots of very rude dances.
Oh my goodness!
I was brought up to be thoroughly prejudiced against the Morris dances,
and yet they show up.
Yeah,
And so far, the orchard is no worse for the wear. There, that's
no,
great.
No. It's really it's great having them. So they turn up. Into the orchard, we provide cider and a barbecue, and we have a huge bonfire. And they kind of
is this an evening event that you
yeah,
do?
Yeah, it's a night
it,
nighttime. It has to be a nighttime.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, we start it in the light,
right? And then it gets dark.
And
lots of torches and things.
So we have a big ring of paraffin torches and a huge bonfire. Yeah,
fun.
In the middle of it, and it is great fun. And then we have singing. Yeah,
singing.
Yeah,
good songs.
Well, we don't sing good songs, but we've got our.
Are you sure you don't sing?
No. We have a guy who looks after who does most of the orchard work.
Right.
So he's one of our team, and he's also a really good folk singer. So he does a lot of singing, mm-hmm. and he's one of the people who drives this process.
So can we keep on going through the months here? Because
I'm curious.
So now we're in. Okay. So the wassail happened in July. I know they do wassails in July in Australia. So makes sense.
Yeah.
August, you are now your cider is tucked away and you're letting it do its thing.
Okay.
Is that true? Or?
No, that's our cider is never tucked away.
Never tucked away.
So basically, so one of the great things about this long harvest, just dwelling on those months from February through to July,
right?
Okay, is that you've got a really it creates a lot of different ferments. So we're getting the apples in. blending is at the heart of everything a cider maker right. does. That's sort of well known. So so we're getting the apples in. We monitor the whole time what's coming in, and we will sit down. I will sit down with Rodrigo, the Chilean winemaker who works with us, and we'll work out, you know, what blends we're going to make from the apples we've got available. And we've kind of got a pretty good idea now of where we're going to end up, because that's one thing that we find is that actually the key characteristics in terms of acidity in particular, but acidity and tannin as well, they're pretty reliable year on year. Which surprised me. I would have thought there would be a big shift. There are a big shift in a lot of parameters, but those parameters seem to be relatively reliable. So we're able to kind of design a blend that we think is going to end up at the right level of acidity, hopefully the right pH, although, as you know, pH can be a bit of a weird monster. Mm-hmm. And so we're doing that on an ongoing basis. And in a given year, we might have up to 20 ferments and 20 different blends. And so they start off with one type of apple. So we might have, for example, the Tom Putz I talked about, blended with a knotted apple. Kernel, mm-hmm. Which is a really beautiful apple. Horrible little thing in terms of the size of the fruit and the harvesting of it, but fantastic. And pressing, really difficult to press, but fantastic quality fruit. So we'll start off with a blend, for example, which is dominated by those two apples. And then we'll move on into blends that maybe have more Kingston Black in them. And Sweet Alford. And then, you know, we'll then move on into blends that have more bittersweet in them. And so we've got the succession of blends. So those ferments, the early ones will tend to be faster because the weather's warmer. We do have temperature control on quite a few of our tanks, but they tend to be warmer. Mm-hmm. And then by the end, it's getting quite cool. We do a combination of inoculated and wild ferments, probably two-thirds, one-third. And mm-hmm. so we tend to leave our wild ferments to later on.
Of course.
And so by the end, when it's cooler, we're doing more wild fermentation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And those wild ferments can really keep ticking pretty well all winter. So whereas the early ferments are fast. So we've got this sort of huge variability in the actual mm-hmm. our process of cider making mm-hmm. across
yeah,
those
yeah,
months.
I'm getting that.
Yeah. And so we're always looking. Basically, there's never a time when you're not looking at a cider in the winter. You're always looking. You've always got to monitor.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't monitor, it's like, you know, you go away, you take your eye off that frying pan or whatever it is, and, you know, you're in trouble.
Yeah, yeah, no doubt. So in September and October, is it pruning time for the orchard?
So September, October. Let me think about this. No, a little bit earlier.
A little earlier. Yeah. So August.
So we tend to wait for the leaves to fall. So we're probably starting pruning towards second half of July.
July, okay.
Into August. Mm-hmm. And then we're trying to finish by mid-September.
Mid-September.
Yeah. And we're the pruning's interesting. But we're learning as we go because we're in the middle of, it would be probably parallels with the US, we're in the middle of an area that grows eating apples for export. Mm-hmm. They've got to look good, basically. Mm-hmm. People eat with their eyes. So mm-hmm. the local knowledge that we've had to learn from has tended to be about how to make one of these big, fat, beautiful-looking apples.
Yeah.
So we're not really interested in that. So we're kind of learning as we go on the grafting as to what we should be looking for in our environment for mm-hmm. cider trees.
Mm-hmm.
And we get massive biennialism. And so we're trying to do pruning and thinning for that. Actually, most pruning for biennialism is summer pruning.
Okay. When is blossom time for you?
Okay.
What month?
Yeah. So we've done our pruning. The orchard's clear. Sheep have come in, cleaned up the orchard floor, eaten apples. Always bring sheep in when there are no leaves on the trees. Mm. They can climb trees. They're amazing.
Oh, my gosh.
If there's green bits, they eat.
That's a label waiting to happen.
Oh, we had these. We had these sheep. We had these kind of this, you know how when you have small holders, they get these weird breeds.
Yes.
We had these weird breeds. They were called Arapawa sheep. They lived on...
Arab?
Arapawa. They were like feral sheep up in Ireland. And somebody thought, we've got to preserve the genetics.
Oh, my
So they
goodness.
Brought them into the orchard. And they were like...
Billy goats.
Billy goats.
Oh, my goodness.
they would climb up. I tell you, the animal stories that I've got about all these books that tell you guinea fowl are great for orchards. They go and eat insects. They do a lot more than eat insects. Oh, they eat anything inside. And then they perch in the trees and defecate on the apples underneath. But that's enough. We never use those in our cider. They were all in our home orchard. But so we don't have any of those anymore. But sorry, I am missing the point. Yes, the sheep have been in when there are no leaves on the trees. Okay. And they've eaten all the dead apples and all the leaves, mm-hmm. and hopefully reduced any inoculum of black spot, we call it. You call it apple scab,
mm-hmm.
etc. And then flowering will happen, will start to happen in sort of late-ish September. Mm. And that flowering will go on for a long time as well. So that will go right
because
through
there's
October.
Different ripenings for different trees. Yeah, the same thing for flowering.
And we've got a few trees that will actually flower earlier. So there's a long flowering time. Incidentally, we've got a few varieties. This is a changing subject, but we've got a few varieties that are struggling because of warming temperatures.
Mm.
They're just not consistently getting the winter chill they need.
They need that drop in temperature. Yeah. What varieties are those? Do you know?
Yeah, the particular variety that we would like to grow, but we've given up on, apart from specimen trees, is Dabinet, actually.
Mm.
Yeah, Dabinet is
a lovely cider apple.
Yeah, a lovely cider apple, but it doesn't grow. But it doesn't matter. We've got plenty of other lovely cider.
Yeah,
apple.
It sounds like you do. So let's get to the rest of the year here. So October.
Yeah.
It's still maybe apple blossom time, or could be lingering a little bit.
No,
some
no,
late
apple,
trees.
It's still apple blossom time.
That's great. How nice to have such a long season for apple blossom.
It's good. I mean, it's good on lot. Yeah, it's good. It's good, and it gives us a bit of security as well, because obviously flowering is a really high risk time for apples in terms of frost.
Yes,
but also in terms of weather and infection. Because most infection gets in at that period of time,
mm-hmm.
so a long blossoming is good.
Do you have to bring bees into your orchard for pollination?
Yeah, we rent bees.
You rent bees, okay?
And so we rent about 6 hives.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that does it. How about now in November? What are you seeing in November?
So,
the blossoms are gone, and you're starting to see those little baby apples.
Yeah, we've got the baby apples that grow into bigger apples, and bigger apples at an amazing speed. You know, you can kind of almost watch them growing. And so we're trying to kind of start to work out what we're looking at crop wise for next year. I mean, we've generally got a fair idea of what the things are looking like from bud development on, but pre-burst actually. Mm-hmm. We look at buds and see whether they've got nascent flowers in them.
Is it a rainy season about then?
The rainiest time is right over flowering, actually.
Oh.
Historically, okay, and the weather is changing.
It's
so
changing.
Much.
Are you seeing it changing pretty rapidly?
Yeah, I think
that's disconcerting. Yeah.
Yeah. So
not a good thing.
No, it's not a good thing because of the. It's not a good thing for lots of reasons, but it's not a good thing because it's very difficult to deal with the lack of predictability. So,
do you get intense storms that come through that maybe threaten the blossoms?
We just had a major one 2 days ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So,
was that a rainstorm or wind?
It was rain and wind. Yeah.
Is that the main type of storm weather patterns that are dangerous for New Zealand? I mean, I get blizzards where I live.
We don't get snowfall where we are. Well,
okay,
we
no snowfall.
No. I mean, we get snowfall just above us.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got mountains with snow on in the background. Mm-hmm. Beautiful. We live in a beautiful place. Talk about
I'm
that
sure
if you want.
I'm sure you do. Yeah.
I mean, we've got snowy caps behind the orchard. And yet we don't get snow.
Mm-hmm.
And we only get moderate frosts and only at night.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it is an issue, and it's just the recurrent. You know, people say this is a 1 in 100 year storm. No, it isn't, because we had one 5 years ago.
Right.
You know, then we had one 5
short-term
years before
memory.
That.
Yeah. So people have short term memories.
Well, it probably statistically has been a 100 year storm, but people are going to have to readjust the fact that it isn't a 100 year storm anymore. So the storm a couple of days ago has destroyed buildings that have been there for 100 years.
Oh no!
Yeah.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Well, luckily not on our orchard, but so our trees have got, so it's actually a very dangerous time for the orchard because the trees are kind of laden with fruit.
Yes, heavy, and they could.
So if you get a strong wind, it knocks fruit off, but it breaks branches, and we don't like broken branches.
Now, December, what do you see in that month?
So just by December, we're hopefully we're getting a bit of heat into the orchard. And don't forget, there's another thing going on at this time, which is that the spring temperatures the rising temperatures in spring have meant that by October time we're starting to focus back into the cidery, because that's when our ciders are beginning to mature.
Okay, yeah. So bottling, you're looking at maybe potentially bottling? No,
a little bit. By October it's going to be a little bit, but we're really starting to focus on what we're going to do, because we've got all these batches of cider available to us.
Okay.
I'll come back to our focus at that stage is probably going back into the cidery more than the orchard. So we've got Kevin, who I mentioned earlier, who's working on the orchard. Mm-hmm. So he'll keep on working on the orchard and mending things that break, and things mm-hmm. break all the time. So we've got a bit of heat developing, and so we'll be doing the standard orchard things, mowing grass, mm-hmm. Keeping weeds from under the trees, which we think is quite an important thing to do, and we'll be looking hard at whether or not there's enough water in the soil. So we've got big trees, and I'm not worried about the big trees. We've also got a lot of new trees, and we've got a dwarf block as well. And I don't favour dwarf trees because for the reason I'm talking about, that they need a level of nurture which I don't feel is appropriate for cider making. Again, that's a very personal view.
Mm-hmm.
Our dwarf block is looking absolutely fantastic this year. Full of fruit. But I'm aware that it's always going to be vulnerable, especially in this context of this changing climate. It's fragile trees tied to wires.
Right.
Whereas the other trees can kind of fend for themselves.
Yeah.
You can see their Kazakhstan.
It's like the big guys
origins.
And the little guys and the...
Yeah. So that's a very personal view. So we do have available irrigation, because historically had long hot summers needed irrigation, especially to support the development of younger trees before mm-hmm. they've managed to get their mm-hmm. roots right down.
Got it.
So we'll be starting to look at whether or not we need to irrigate, and. Generally speaking, we don't do that much irrigation, because generally speaking, we don't have to.
And then
we're getting into December, and that's more or less the same.
Mm-hmm.
And then January, we're out in the orchard. I mentioned thinning earlier for biennialism. It's a really tricky one. We don't do chemical thinning, because it's just too risky with such a wide range of varieties in proximity mm-hmm. to each other. So we have experimented with hand thinning for biennialism, but it's very expensive to get somebody to go out and manually thin that trees. But we'll be looking at what thinning we need to do just in terms of branch breaking.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll be saying that row looks a bit heavy, and we'll be going in there and we'll be clearing a whole lot of fruit out off the trees to stop those branches breaking later on. So that's probably a job for that month, where we are. When then we're back to harvest again.
Back to harvest again.
The cycle goes on.
It's a busy, busy life for the cider maker.
Yeah, it is. It goes on. Yeah.
Well, that sure helped me, and I suspect you, on getting a sense of the growing season and the cider making schedule in New Zealand. Next up, Alex and I will be talking a little bit about the cider market, and then we'll be rolling into talking specifically about Peckham's cider and some of his cider making techniques.
I liken it to cheese. Yeah. Do they do those little packets of sliced cheese with bits of plastic between them? Okay. Yeah. So most cider is like that. Yeah.
Right.
So people have got people. If you say to people, "What is cider?" They'll point.
Look at that. that's all they know. Yeah.
That's all they know. So you've got to move people from that right over to a ripe Camembert, you know, farmhouse Camembert that's trying to run away from the plate, and it's quite a palate progression, especially if people say, well, that's not cheese as I know it. You know, what I know is the stuff that's got pre-sliced and got the plastic between the slices. Our main competition, if you will, is to say to people, well, actually, that's not really what cheese is. This is what cheese is. So we're moving. And then the other thing is that we're really competing against craft beer, I think. We're not competing, I don't think, in the sense that we're competing against craft beer at the level of the individual consumer. I think we're competing against it in terms of shelf space. So,
and we see that here too. I think that's actually, though, in some ways, that's a good thing, because it makes the fact that there's even cider to put on the shelf, to me, is a good thing. Versus, because they're probably not putting the Alka-Pop cider next to the craft beer, are they? Would they put that in a different section of the store versus the cider that you make would be taking the same shelf space as a craft beer?
No, our cider will be next to the Alka-Pop.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it will be next to the Alka-Pop.
Okay.
I mean, I should say, New Zealand strict Alka-Pops are not allowed to be sold in the grocery store. They can only be sold in a proper wine outlet.
Oh, okay. All right.
So there are quite strict rules on what can and can't be.
So they have you side by side.
They will have us side by side with the Alka-Pop ciders. When I say competition, it's a very complex thing. It's not, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe competition's not the right word, but we're definitely not competing in the wine market. We're competing in the craft beer market. And that's a shame. And that comes from a historical fact that, you know, people think of, and you know, I'll drink a pint of cider, but people think of it as a pint drink.
Mm-hmm.
And so, to the extent I can tell you a story, we produce an ice cider in a 375 ml bottle.
A long, tall, thin bottle,
yeah.
Right.
We don't use any, it's not a fancy bottle, it's a standard...
like a dessert
standard
wine.
Bordeaux style.
Okay.
A miniature Bordeaux style bottle. And, you know, we got a wonderful internet review with somebody with a pint glass, a whole lot of ice. They tip this ice cider into the pint glass and they're going, "Nice, but a bit sweet."
For sure.
Well, that's because people think it's got cider written on it. It's drunk in a pint glass, you know.
And so that learning curve at the kind of bottom level. But I think
it's moving fast.
It's moving fast. Yeah.
But what we really want is we want somebody to say, okay, I'm drinking late harvest wines. I'm going to try that and see what an apple equivalent is.
Yeah.
And then we want them to put it in an elegant small glass, take a moderate amount and savor it. And then think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And there are an increasing number of people, so we are seeing the market shifting, really shifting. So we're seeing people moving away from that sliced cheese, and there's information market information that backs that up, and we're seeing them move towards more sophisticated ciders. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that we're seeing them move towards drier ciders.
Drier ciders, you are seeing that. That's
so we're getting more and more people demanding drier ciders.
Good, great.
Yeah,
great.
Which is really good.
Yes, it is. Yeah, that's great. Exactly where you want to be. Are you a little bit of modern and traditional in your styles in that you do a very kind of quick turnover cider?
No, we don't do any
you
quick
don't,
turnover
no quick
cider.
Turnover.
No,
okay.
We don't. So we don't do any quick turnover cider.
They all condition.
They're all what we call vintage cider. Well, I know that's not a term that you use here, but they're all vintage in the sense that they're made at harvest from tree ripened fruit, and they're all matured. So do not do those quick turnaround ciders. But we've got two basic classifications ranges, if you want. We've got our classic range. So our classic range does contain ciders with fruit, and I can talk about that because there are a lot of purists that would object to that.
Mm-hmm. They don't consider that real cider if it has any kind of anything in it other than apple.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, the reality is that we're in that beer market. We're on that in the shelf. We're not on the wine shelf, and that's just the reality. And the brewers are allowed to experiment with all these things.
Somehow
it's frowned down on cider. And I kind of, because I want it to be over there with the wine, I kind of have a lot of empathy for that view that cider should be just fermented apple juice. Mm-hmm. And that's probably where I would like to be, but the reality is it's more complex than that. And we live in an area which has like the most abundant fruit. It's fantastic. So we've got it's the largest area. We grow more boysenberries than anywhere else.
Really?
We used to grow boysenberries on our own property.
Wow.
So the first year we were there, we grew 75 tons of them. But anyway, they were too prickly for us, so we planted apple trees. So we've got black currants locally. Mm-hmm. We've got these feijoa locally. And we've got amazing hop production. We're again the main hop producers in New Zealand in our region.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems natural that we should marry those things together.
Mm-hmm.
As long as we stick to the philosophy of getting ripe whole fruit.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's what we've done. So we've got our classic range, and our classic range is designed to be fruit driven. We're looking for really clean. If it's in our Mutri cider, which is our flagship cider, we're looking for good fruit. We're looking for moderate sweetness. We're looking for that to be balanced with a moderate acidity, not a high acidity.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're looking for a tannin profile, a tiny bit of bitterness and a little bit of astringency, but not too much.
Mm.
So we're looking for something that is going to be, what would I say it's going to be? It's not going to be the Camelback, it's going to be the aged cheddar. Okay? You know, which is something that a lot of people will enjoy, and it's not going to be something where they're going to sit there and spend a lot of time analyzing the different organisms that have been involved in the production of it. And then we've got our special release ciders. And so we've been releasing about a cider a month, cider every 6 weeks from the cellar. So we look at the cellar, and the cellar's like got all these barrels and tanks and from the process I described earlier. So it's our larder, from which we can draw ingredients to make, to blend, because the blending so we talked about blending earlier, about blending the apples at harvest, so we've got also the blending of the ciders once they're finished. That's another thing, so we can make lots of very different style ciders by careful blending of the ingredients we've got available.
Yes.
So that's where our monthly releases come. It's not because,
nice.
Not because we're making a cider a month.
Right, right.
Yeah,
no,
yeah,
but
yeah,
you're blending and creating a unique profile for that month. That's great.
So a lot of those special ciders will have a high component of wild fermentation. I don't know if we've talked about that yet.
We haven't, no. I'd love to.
Okay, so we're probably, at the moment, we're probably two-thirds inoculated. So in other words, we add a commercial yeast about two-thirds of our ciders.
Is that straight across the board with all your ciders? Or when you say wild ferment,
And then about a third of them are wild fermented.
Okay, all right.
So spontaneous ferment, whatever you want to call it.
Right, I want to make sure I understood that.
Good,
got it.
So it is, in my mind, There are two reasons for that. The first is that those two ranges, the classic range and the special release range, limited release range, we keep changing the name of it. But one of them, we're looking for a relatively high degree of reproducibility. So our Moutry side from 1 year to another, we don't expect it to taste the same in the same way as a wine, a proper vintage wine won't taste the same from one year to another. So there's going to be variation, but it's still got to have a characteristic and a profile that belongs to it. So we find that we can do that more effectively with an inoculation, because that yeast is going to really have an impact on the character, and it's going to give it a house style. It's going to help give it a house style. Whereas with a wild ferment, the exact the time, the temperature, the particular blend of apples, the particular organisms you've got present, there's so many variables that you do have a wider degree of it. You have a much wider wider variability. That variability is often sort of portrayed as a bad thing. In my experience, you don't get many bad wild ferments.
That's good to hear, because a lot of people are very scared to do. And I know scared is a strong word, but there's a fear that you're going to put, you know, X amount of gallons or liters of cider and it could go bad.
It's like everything else. It's got to be done properly and it's got to be managed properly.
Did you have a doubt when you first started cider making that you're going to do wild ferment? Did you go into that slowly, or you were just like, of course we're doing wild ferment?
Well, we probably did more wild fermenting initially. Wild fermenting doesn't create that same consistent profile. There's no doubt about it. It creates a better cider, in my opinion, a variable cider, exciting cider, if done properly. But it takes a lot more time.
It's a slow fermentation.
And it's not only the fermentation, it's the maturation as well.
Basically
what we find is with a high tannin apple, a wild ferment, it takes anywhere from 8 to 10 months to mature. I mean, you take longer than that if you want. But I mean, before it's really rounded, it takes a long time. So I think if I have a drawback for wild ferment, it is that. Now, that might not be an experience that other cider makers would support. I don't know. I mean, one of the things that we in New Zealand is we're probably pretty well the only, one of a very, very small number of commercial cideries that will be doing any wild ferment. So we haven't got things to compare with other people. So we love wild ferment. But you have to be really, really
patient. It could be a bugger, no doubt about it. That's the word on the street. I just think it's encouraging to hear your approach to wild fermentation. And for anyone listening who has any trepidation, you know, it's sound judgment. You got to approach it kind of methodically, but let the cider do its work and kind of trust. And the beauty of it is when you're doing a wild ferment, and I'm opening a bottle of wild ferment somewhere else in the world. I don't know if you export any of your wild ferments, do you?
Well, tomorrow we're tasting one. Okay. Oh, no, today.
It's today, right, yeah, today. Yeah, yeah. But we have the opportunity to taste your land in that bottle.
Yeah.
And that is so unique, you know.
I think you do. I think to a certain extent you do as well in the inoculated ones. Yeah.
But the yeast will dictate with inoculated. You know, the yeast brings in
that particular group of organisms and the collection, that ecosystem only exists in our cidery, doesn't it?
Even in the wild fermentation, you're going to be getting a little bit of that cultured yeast because that's in your cider house.
Yeah.
So you have that there, but I think as you kind of take away all these other, you know, additives, and not a good choice of word, but we're getting closer to me sitting out in your orchard, smelling, sniffing the air in New Zealand,
absolutely.
And the sunshine and the people. I mean, that's the beauty of a wild ferment. I love hearing that you're doing that.
Yeah. Maybe we should not call them wild ferments, call them feral ferments. Because you're right. You know, we've influenced that ecosystem. We've chucked in a whole load of yeast into our tanks, and they'll be influencing it. So whether it's a wild or a feral one, I don't know.
Feral has kind of an odd word to it. I think
I know. It's got a negative context.
It does. You think of the feral cat who's waiting in the back corner who doesn't want to be captured and spraying in the barn. Not that we don't love those cats.
I know. Okay, we won't use the word feral. It's not got any. It's not sexy at all.
It's okay. It gives you pause, and we think it's good to have pause and think about it.
I'm just aware, like you say, that
wine is using natural now. They're saying natural wine, and that it's kind of doing like a wild, you know, spontaneous fermentation.
Yeah,
that's another word you could use, and that's too clinical.
Yeah.
So I like wild because on the podcast we have the talking palms, and we also have the wild yeast. They're kind of cartoon characters on the podcast.
Yeah,
and I always think of the voice for the wild yeast as being.
I'll stick with white. I'll put the word feral to the back of my mind. But obviously there's tons of information out there on wild fermenting, but the really important things about it are clean fruit.
Clean fruit.
You want clean fruit. Use sulfite. I know there are a lot of
sulfites.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh.
Not a lot.
Okay.
We use a low dose of sulfite to knock back. Those organisms that we don't want to dominate the beginning of the ferment. I'll come back to that.
Interesting.
And then the third component is be patient. Be patient.
And don't be scared if it's taking a long time. This is part of the process.
Yeah.
Because it takes a while for them to kind of compete. And I think of the wild yeast as not one type of like cell, if you will.
Yeah.
They're kind of like, okay, everybody's moved into the neighborhood, and now we want to see who's going to be kind of the leader here.
Yeah. Well, that's why it's great, because you've got this succession of organisms involved in the fermentation.
Yeah.
So on the whole, with our wild yeasts, we will use that sulfur dioxide, and to my mind, it's crucial. But that's why you don't want to chuck in a whole load of nutrients, because you've got to let that succession do its thing.
Well, I'm curious. Can we go back to the sulfite? At what stage are you putting the sulfite in?
Because sulfite, yeah? The SO2.
SO2.
Yeah.
But at what stage are you putting that
in? Okay, so we're putting that into the juice.
Into the juice.
Yeah, pre-fermentation at a very low level. Now,
wouldn't that kind of direct the wild yeast in, or you're trying to?
It does create a certain amount of direction.
Yeah.
So in the sense that it favors the Saccharomyces yeasts over some of the non-Saccharomyces yeasts, but also some of the bacteria. And I have tasted. There are quite a lot of people who believe you should take the apple juice and put it in a tank or a barrel and just let it do its thing. Mm-hmm. And when I taste those ciders, this is my palate. Everybody's got an individual palate. Mm-hmm. When I taste those ciders, they tend to have a really high degree of influence from Acetobacter. So they've got nail varnish and vinegar in them as a part of the profile. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm aware that some people don't mind that.
Mm-hmm.
I
call that a sour cider sometimes.
We made a sour cider. It's got none of those characteristics in it. But that's another matter. For example, Andrew Lee, he's pretty strong a recommendation of the use of sulfur. And definitely, if you just use a little bit of sulfur to knock back those organisms at the beginning, you'll get a much cleaner ferment, and you'll end up with a product that has all the complexity you want, but doesn't have those flaws that can be derived from the early success of those bugs in your juice. Basically, the addition of sulfite to a cider is totally pH dependent.
Mm-hmm.
So
it will really depend on what we'll do. I don't know how technical.
Because you're not going to adjust the pH of the wild.
We've done that through the blending process.
Okay.
But then we've got a juice. We'll do a titratable acidity to work it out, to check how much malic acid we've got in that juice. And that's really important from a sensory point of view, because you get an idea from drinking a juice, but you've got this variability in the sweetness of the juice. Mm-hmm. And once you strip out that sweetness, you're just left with the acid. Mm. Yeah. So you want to measure the acid so you've got an idea what it's going to be like when it goes dry.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll do that. We're looking for different ciders. We're looking for particular ranges of malic acid. And then we measure pH. And obviously pH and titratable acidity are linked, but they're not. Mm-hmm. They don't parallel each other. And then we've got to be within the standard ranges, you know, the standard ranges for cider. The basic problem is that top range, which we don't ever like to be above 3.7, the pH of 3.7. Ideally, we'd never like to be above 3.6, 3.65. Mm-hmm. We find that on the whole, and again, there's that relationship, the relationship between pH and titratable acidity is complex. We find on the whole that if we go below 3.5, it's going to be, the likelihood is we're going to end up with a cider that's a little bit too acidic. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily a problem, because we've got this larder full of ciders, so we can choose a less acidic one to blend it with.
Yeah.
So it's not, and we can also use malolactic fermentation to reduce acidity.
That down. Yeah.
Again, if you want to use malolactic fermentation, you've got to really start with a high titratable acidity.
Mm-hmm. It could drop too low.
Really high.
Yeah.
You're probably looking at a much lower, a significantly lower pH, because otherwise it'll drop too far and it'll become flabby.
Right.
So. The question was about sulfite addition. So that will vary, but it will tend. Let's just come up with a figure. It'll tend, that initial addition will tend to be between 30 and 50 parts per million.
Okay.
In the lab, there are some important bits of equipment.
Very important.
Ability to titrate. Ability to take accurate pH meters, and pH meters are a really good thing to invest in, and also an ability to measure sulfur dioxide, so measure free and total sulfur dioxide.
Mm-hmm.
So those to me, I think
that's the science. Key. That's the science of it,
and also ability to measure sugar.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
We're also introducing a certain number of other bugs into our environment.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, please. What are you introducing?
Well, we're playing around, and again, a lot of the more consistency driven cider people are scared of these organisms. But if you go back and look at the beautiful profiles of some of the more complex European ciders, they have a large influence from things like lactobacillus, Brettanomyces, as long as it's not producing Band-Aid and stuff, it still has a fantastic role. So we're increasingly sort of experimenting with these organisms, they are having a radical. They're allowing us to expand the profile of flavors we're producing.
Mm.
I love them. I think they're great. Okay, from a personal point of view. And what I've been surprised about, because they're definitely on the right camembert.
And what I've been surprised
about is how consumers quite like them as well. So that's really positive.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a lot of consumers who do. I'm one of them.
Yeah.
I really appreciate that. I kind of call it like the funk. It's like a good funk. You know.
Yeah.
It really brings you into a complex cider. It's really exciting.
And then I think the other thing is to talk about cider is the potential for experimentation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just a matter of taking an apple, sort of blending it with another apple, milling it, juicing it, putting it in a tank, letting it either wild ferment or inoculating. There are a lot of other things you can do.
Mm-hmm.
So the role of maceration is one that's really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
How long you macerate.
How long do you normally macerate? Do you have a schedule in that way, or it's kind of
fluid? It's fluid. And okay. it will depend on what we're trying to achieve. Mm-hmm. So last year we did some really quite extreme macerations. So we did a single varietal King's Black, for example, that we milled. So we ended up with mm-hmm. our milled apple. We put it in a tank. We introduced a non-Saccharomyces yeast that was that's a special used in the wine industry, Telespora dubrucki, and it kind of infiltrates nooks and crannies that the bad organisms would and it yeah. colonizes them. Right. That's the idea of it to keep the cider safe, and then we left that for 5 days. Tiny bit of alcoholic fermentation it creates as well. It extracts massive amount of mouthfeel from the apple pulp.
Did you mix that into the? This yeah. was mixed into the pumice, right?
Yeah.
So how do you mix that in? Like, or do you have like a one of those like kind of corkscrew from the grinder where it's
no,
just
no. The amazing thing about
the pumice
milled apple,
yeah,
is that it will release a phenomenal amount of juice on its own.
Absolutely.
So you put it in a tank, and you will have all the apple pulp, all the apple solid, most of the apple solids will float up to the top, and the bottom will be juice.
Yeah.
So as long as you've got some sort of crude strainer at the bottom of your tank, the crude, what I mean is things that will stop big chunks going through.
Right.
You can just do a pump over.
I see.
So you just pump the juice out
Brilliant.
Of the bottom and then pour it onto
Brilliant.
The top.
Yeah.
And then you keep that. So we with that type of cider, we'd pump it over twice a day.
Okay.
Do a lot of pumping over to keep the whole thing mixed.
Right.
And also to one of the problems you have, it's very technical, but one of the problems you have is when you have that mass of apple, the apple pulp floating
right.
on top, is that it's not in the liquid. Yeah.
Yes.
You need to keep it in the liquid.
Yeah. So.
So that helps.
That helps quite a bit. Yeah, it's moving around.
All over
yeah.
it. And then you know, obviously, there are things you need to do, like keep a good carbon dioxide head on top of it. But again, if you've got a little bit of fermentation, you tend to have a bit of carbon dioxide.
It'd
but
be
you can,
okay.
You
yeah.
can add it. So, yeah. So we did that, and then
wow.
And then we free drained it.
You what?
Free drained it.
Free drained
so
it.
Let
okay.
It, we
let it just
free,
drain out
free run.
From there.
So
and then
we actually put it in the press.
Oh, and let it free drain
with buckets.
With buckets, yep.
Well,
course.
We pump the juice
of
out.
Of course,
the rest of it with buckets, and then we let it drain from the press.
And how long are you letting that drain for? Like overnight, or
it'll happen. It'll happen fast. Yeah, it'll be a
okay.
few hours. And
a few hours,
and then we put that in oak. And
so you separate that from the pressed juice.
We don't press.
You don't press, so it's just
no,
free drain.
We don't press, we just free drain.
No kidding, wow.
Well, that's what we did with this one.
Interesting.
And we get, you know, we probably got a 20% yield loss or something over time,
mm-hmm.
but basically, by the time you've...
Wow.
That's
like a winemaking technique in a way.
It is.
But that more like advanced kind of first run, that's really separate from any kind of pressing.
Yeah, it's something that I think is going to be quite... I mean, if the market is there that supports experimentation, then I think things like the use of free run juice
mm-hmm.
in cider making is going to be something we can all explore, because it's definitely the highest quality juice.
Yes.
The books say it isn't, for some reason. They say the stuff that comes out at the end is the same as the stuff that comes out. It ain't.
But not in wine. Not in the wine world.
We've tested it. The stuff that comes out later in the pressing is totally different. It's got different pH,
absolutely.
Different sugar,
yeah.
different tannin. Everything's different about it.
And for someone who's non-commercial, they could still press that way if they want to and blend that cider in and keep it separate, which would be a very nice experiment to do.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you could see that actually it is quite different.
Yeah.
I think that's really...
So there's a lot of experimentation we can
fun.
All do. And
fun.
Yeah,
I like that.
Yeah.
I've done first run wines myself, and it's an exciting piece. To hear that you're doing that with cider is
really
piqued my curiosity.
It's a pretty full-on cider. We didn't make very much of it. We sold it all, luckily. But
right.
Yeah. It's... So being Kingston Black,
a single varietal Kingston Black
done. It's a bit of bitterness in there, as you'd expect. Quite a lot of astringency. The astringency is still balanced.
And you would bottle that in a.
We again, I think we made
800 litres of it.
Okay.
What's that, 200 gallons? A very
small amount. Yeah, small batch.
Yeah.
Do you have a tasting room?
No.
No tasting room.
No.
So it's kind of, if the cider tourist is coming to New Zealand, they should call and set up something ahead.
Look, everybody tells us we should have a tasting room, and we're mad not to have a tasting room, but it...
A little bit too much.
It's just another thing.
Yeah.
I mean, okay. You need to have it manned.
Seek out Peckham Cider. Well, I want to thank you for your time. It's just been so enjoyable.
Thank you.
The way you kind of talk about things, your passion, and sharing the piece of the world that I don't know too much about. So,
well, you should come down there. It's worth a visit. It's a really great place, actually.
Yeah, who wouldn't want to go to New Zealand?
Wear sunscreen.
Okay.
The UV is ferocious, which is why the apples grow so fast.
Right.
It's great. Really, really lovely place.
What a lovely chat with Alex Peckham of Peckham Cider in New Zealand. I had a chance to have one of the cans of the Wild All the Way, and on the can it says, a blend of three wild ferments that have been maturing for over a year. A rich caramel Kingston Black single variety, a gentle yet tannic bittersweet blend, and a complex oak fermented and matured perry. The result is a rich kiwi cider with deep English cider country roots. This cider had a little bit of funk and balance that just knocked my socks off. Fantastic cider. This is imported by the Shelton Brothers. You could also find Peckham Cider in Taiwan. So if you are out of the U.S. and looking for a place to get some cider, that is one of the spots that you might be able to find it. And Taiwan, that's pretty cool too. They're trying to make their reach, so if you want to check out a cidery that's really worth your time and palate, check out Peckham Cider. I also have this can here of the Kingston and Alford. It's made with a touch of honey. One of the things that Alex said is that he does like canning ciders because he feels that actually, in the short kind of synopsis of what he said, you could pasteurize it, and really, because the can cools down quicker than the glass, he feels that it actually has a better stability and quality for holding the cider. There's links in the show notes, and you could see the calendar that I took notes on as he talked through the Southern Hemisphere. So if you're thinking about visiting New Zealand. What is one of the smallest countries with one of the biggest cideries? Well, that would be Luxembourg. And if you want to hear more about Rambourne Cider Company, just go to episode 129. And if you have been thinking about kombucha and probiotics and how that feels for your body, well, sometimes you shouldn't think too much about it. In fact, if you listen to episode 133 called A Chemical Fingerprints with John Edwards, he might make you kind of think twice about what's in that glass. He does a cider analysis. He works with commercial cideries, and he is a top-notch individual. He did a presentation at CiderCon. It is fully visible on the Cider Chat YouTube channel. So you can go there, check that out. It is well worth your time if you like to delve deep into what is happening with cider and some of the things that one needs to do in terms of labeling and nutrition value. And then, of course, coming up is the Ross Cider and Perry Fest on August 31st through September 2nd. Now, what is that? Well, that is based out in Herefordshire in West County that we know is in the UK. So let's say you fly into London, or better yet, you fly into Bristol. And then it's a short sweep heading up to Herefordshire. Ross Cider is, along with these other individuals such as John Edwards and Rambourne Cider Company, they're all part of the Cider Going Up campaign. And they just make the most amazing cider. And I feel so lucky that I discovered them, feels like years ago now, on that first sip. It really blew my socks off. So check out Ross on Wye if you get to have their cider. They have
open tasting room. You could go there. But if you are in the area on August 31st through September 2nd, in fact, if you're flying out there, throwing your sleeping bag in a tent, you could camp out too. That's coming up. I'll have a link in the show notes to that. And of course, if you're down in Philadelphia, check out Current Cider. Their new Fishtown location is open. Seems like they're doing a whole bunch of range of ciders. And if you want to hear more about some of their barrel aging ciders, go to episode 135. That's just a couple episodes ago, because this is episode 139. So it's four episodes ago. And that was called Viejo High Pours in Fishtown. And Fishtown is just a section of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. All these commercial cideries and individuals do support this podcast. And of course, there's some other folks out there who just love the podcast. So a big tip of the glass to all of you. I'm going to be posting right after I get off this onto Patreon, a little behind the scenes chat, little additional chat that I did with Jennifer Dean from County Cider up in Ontario. I like to take off little pieces sometimes and put it out to Patreon. So I'm going to be posting that straight away. I get a little bit more from Jennifer, who just is just full of so much info. You can listen to her episode. I believe that was episode 136. I don't know. It's a couple back there. There's just so many. It's kind of hard to keep up. So just, you know, go and Google Jennifer Dean. It's spelled J-E-N, just one N, F-E-R, Dean, County Cider. It's one of the oldest cideries in Ontario, Canada. You could become a patron too. Just go to the Cider Chat Patreon page. There is a link at the website, ciderchat.com. You might think after 139 episodes that the abundance out there in Ciderville would be kind of waning, but it isn't. There are so many great stories to tell, and I have some good ones queued up just for you. So hang tight. It might be the summer in the Northern Hemisphere, but we are still working here very hard in the Cider House at Mount Mineral to keep on getting these episodes out to you. So take care until then, and keep that cider glass full. This is Rio Windcaller signing off for now. Looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
Yeehaw!